Yeah! Welcome to the Soulcast. Pre-recorded, not live, from the northeastern hinterlands of the so-called United States. And today, I have a very important, exciting, and awesome episode for you. It's one of my rare kind of how-to episodes. So if you are not yet sick of hearing permaculture and farming and gardening episodes, you are in luck. And if you are sick of that shit, then you're still in luck. Because today, I got my homie, Evan Dukas from Colorado, and we're going to be going really in-depth talking about how to build a climate battery greenhouse. Now, what is a climate battery greenhouse? Well, a climate battery greenhouse, by my definition, is a greenhouse that uses sort of geothermal technologies to efficiently heat and cool greenhouses. And this is a great technology for people living in colder climates, temperate climates. So whether you're in Maine or Canada or, you know, in Northern Europe, this technology is fucking incredible. Basically, what it does is it takes, in the winter and when it's cool out, it takes hot air from the earth, from below the earth, and pumps it through the greenhouse to keep it warm. And in the summer, it pushes cold air through the greenhouse from below the earth to cool it down. And Evan is someone who built this years and years ago while the technology was still available online, while it was still open source. Evan, built one of these things for next to nothing using recycled windows. And I've been in his greenhouse. Not only is it crazy to see all these lemons and oranges and things like that growing in Colorado, but it has, the air in there feels really nice, and it's just, they're incredible. These things, through all my research of permaculture and next generation gardening stuff, this is one of the coolest technologies I've ever witnessed. I became aware of it through the work of Jerome Ostentowski and someone who I interviewed back a while ago, Stephanie, from Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute. You can check out that interview. And you can go watch some of their videos and see some of the crazy-ass shit that they're doing. But basically, what Evan is going to do is patiently and thoroughly go through every step of the process on how you can create one of these climate battery greenhouses on your own for as cheaply as possible. So whether you're doing this now or whether you're going to do it later, listen to this interview. And if you have questions, if you enjoy this interview, get at us. And this is, just in general, a great conversation. We're going to open it up kind of talking about, Evan's life, what led him to this, what plants and stuff he's geeking out on currently. We're going to talk about some stuff about health and probiotics and shit like that. But Evan was in my permaculture design certificate course in Denver. And him and I instantly bonded. He was one of the... He was geeking out on plants harder than anyone else in that room, and had already been growing a lot of the stuff that I was interested in. And so, it's always great when you can just nerd out with friends about shit like this. So I'm not going to continue blabbing on, but much love to Evan for taking the time to go through all his notes, to get these formulas out there, to help popularize this technology that will only become more important as global warming and climate change continues to ravage the earth. As the temperatures become more erratic all over, sadly, it's going to become more important to use technologies like this so that we can have stable food supplies. Many people may or may not know, we just announced the new Solon DJ Payne 1 album. It's called No God Nor Country. You can go to tinyurl.com/No God Nor Country and pre-order it. We're using Kickstarter for that. And, We're about a third of the way to having it funded, but we still have a long ways to go. So if you want to get that album, please pick it up. And as usual, you can back this podcast on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/SOLEONE. And now before we get into this interview, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network. And just as like a heads up, my son makes a couple appearances on this podcast episode throughout. It's, you know, it's cute or whatever. It's not something I like to happen a lot, but because I messed up with scheduling and got some things confused and ended up having some childcare scheduling issues during this interview. And so if you hear my son chiming in throughout various parts towards the end of this conversation and you think it's unprofessional, I agree. But it is what it is. And yeah, in general, I try to, like, you know, keep a good distance with all that stuff. But sometimes when you're working out of the home, shit just happens. So thanks for listening, and I hope you get as much out of this podcast episode as I do.
Hi, my name's Eamon Farrelly, and I have a podcast. How original, right? It's called Radical People, and it's about radical people. Basically, I sit down and I interview people who I find very interesting. Interesting why? Interesting because they took a look at the world around them, saw a need, saw a problem perhaps, and they decided to address that need or fix that problem. How? With direct action. That's right, not by begging the dirty government and its politicians and bureaucrats, and not by lobbying corporations to please, please, please stop being so awful. No, they get together with some comrades or some homies or just whoever, and they implement whatever solution they see fit, however they see fit to do it. So, that's my podcast. I listen to these people's stories, which turn out to be sometimes very funny, sometimes very scary, sometimes harrowing, always edifying, sometimes titillating. Actually, I haven't had one yet that's been titillating. I know, like, making things a little sexed up generally sells, but typically when people are, those are ISIS soldiers, it doesn't get as sexy as you think. Or maybe it does, and they just haven't told me that part yet. So anyway, you should listen to my podcast if you just happen to be really bored or on a road trip or you just need to drown out what's going on around you. Check out Radical People by searching for it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or by checking out the Channel Zero Network. So yeah, that's my commercial for my show. Thank you for listening to my commercial for my show.
And when we die, we will die with our hearts on
fire. All right. Evan Dukas, man, welcome to the Soulcast.
Hey, thanks, bud. It's so good. Good to be here.
Yeah. You know, it's so cool to have you on. You know, we were both in the taking a permaculture design course last year in Denver, and we're probably, you know, I don't know, like some of the biggest plant geeks in the class, and you know, and you're doing all this awesome shit. So it's good to have you on to, you know, to get you to talk about some of your work.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I always love sharing my work, and sometimes I feel kind of like a nerd. So it just feels good to meet someone else who loves to talk and you know, shoot back and forth and absorb. And yeah, I'm just glad to be on.
Yeah, it's fun, man. You know, we don't talk all the time, but every time I discover a new plant, I'm like, oh, I gotta send it to Evan. You know, like he'll like this. Oh man. So yeah, we're here mostly to talk about climate battery greenhouses, which is like a, I mean, can you, you know, but before we get into talking about climate battery greenhouses, I'd like to just kind of talk about like what brought you to this and like kind of talk about, you know, your interest in these sorts of things. So I guess let's just start there. Like how did you come to, you know, permaculture and stuff? Or is it coming from like a more, is it sort of like a religious kind of back to Eden kind of thing? Is it like some doomsday prepper shit? Like what brought you to all this stuff?
Yeah, so as you know, Tim, there are a lot of there are a lot of pages to this book, let's just say, whatever. But to keep it narrow enough, yeah, you know, from a young age, I grew up in a very food loving, you know, garden loving home. My father's actually from Greece, a small mountain town in the Peloponnese, and my mother's Italian American. So my father was a huge gardener, loves to cook. He is a chef by trade. You know, he's a professional chef. That's what he does. And of course, being an Italian American, my mom cooks as well. So, you know, there was just always that kind of passion for growing food and cooking the food. So, you know, that sort of farm to table thing was really big with me from the beginning. You know, I had a lot of influence from my parents and, you know, experienced a lot of the goodness of just, you know, fresh food grown in the garden and you know, brought to the plate within a very short period of time. You know, that short distance between the ground and the plate was kind of something that I took for granted, but then realized growing up that there was just such a huge gap in understanding, you know, what happens between the two and how things are grown and grown well. So, you know, that was like the earliest type of, you know, instilling that I had. And then, yeah, just, you know, like as I grew up and got married and had a family, I just really followed my dad's tendencies as it pertained to the garden, at least, and really enjoyed gardening. You know, as you know, I definitely have a very strong faith as well. It's just part of my life. So, like, I love the idea of God and life and creation and how things come together, symbiotically work together. I think mainstream scientific theory is a lot about that sort of like contest and survival of the fittest and you know, like how things you know, really work against each other. But when I look in nature, I see a lot of symbiosis. I see so much relationship and oneness in so many things. So yeah, I kind of had those ideas from the onset as well. And I really got into, you know, Back to Eden when I was exposed to that film and that method and that movement. I was like, wow, like, this is it. It just made so much sense, really brought a lot of things together. And in that film, that was the first time I heard the word permaculture. And so when I looked up permaculture, as it's defined, as you know, like, you know, so many different ways, I just really love that basic definition of really, you know, obviously permanent agriculture, things that are sustainable and last and work well, but really just like in its raw form, I just see that it's so much about exploring nature, discovering nature and how nature works so synergistically and sustainably, and then replicating that in our gardens and in our homes and in our lives. So that's what got me into permaculture itself.
Yeah, that's actually a great definition of permaculture. I'm always like asked to define it, and I'm always like, I was like bumble through it. So it's a way to give a good on the fly definition. I mean, it's funny what you were saying about, like, you know, science and everything, you know, symbiosis, that, you know, we're like, our society like thinks it's like Darwinistic, and you know, that's where like capitalism draws a lot of its you know, ideas from, is like this, like, you know, view of competition in nature. But a lot of people, you know, they look at like I was reading, you know, Peter Kropotkin is a thinker that a lot of anarchists look to, and he was someone who looked at nature and was like, oh man, y'all got Darwin wrong. Like, there's tons of, like, even Darwin saw the symbiosis in nature, and, like, you know, these people just like took all the worst shit out of it and built a whole world out of it. And, you know, there's like, it's totally competitive. I mean, totally, collaborative and symbiotic. I didn't know that Back to Eden was a documentary. It's just like something I just keep coming across, sort of like, permaculture people with like a religious background talking about Back to Eden. So it's I guess sure. I should check that documentary out.
You definitely should. I mean, just you know, for nothing else, just like what Paul Gauci, you know, the gentleman, really exposes big time. And I don't think he ever even like totally says this in exact words or anything like that, but But, you know, there's this theme, this motif that's prevalent throughout the film of how it's all about the soil. It's all like about under our feet. And, you know, to no longer look at soil as just some medium, you know, just some like material that's just there for plants to sink their roots in, into whatever, but it's more of like, it's an actual system and it's an actual, you know, grouping or system of life, you know, and there's just so much life, happening in all different stages and levels in the soil. So when you really focus on the life of the soil, in turn, you'll be focusing, even indirectly on the life of the plant. And that's really, like, to me, that's kind of the, you know, if there's like a, like sort of a, you know, quote unquote secret of gardening, or like, you know, one of those things to being successful as a horticulturalist or just a gardener or hobbyist, it's really just learning that about the soil and feeding the soil rather than your plants. Because if you just focus on the soil, your plants will in turn give you a lot of reward.
Yeah, I'm reading this book right now, The Intelligent Gardener. Do you know this book?
No, it sounds familiar, though.
It's just all about, like, soil health, and it's just fascinating. And they just do studies from people all over the world and, like, you know, people homesteading in New York. You know, they're eating all their own certified organic food, but then still after, you know, 30 years of doing it, their teeth are falling out and they're like, what the fuck? What's going on here? And, yeah. They're like comparing it with like people who live in the mountains of Italy or people who live like on Polynesian islands where like it's volcanic rich. And, it basically like, I'm still halfway through it, but it's just like learning about like that there's even more to soil than just like amending it and, you know, sheet mulching it and composting it, that there's like a whole, like, there's all like, you can do all that stuff and the nutrients still won't stay in the soil. You know, it's like the way your body can only absorb so many nutrients. The soil is the same way. And so you have to, like, you know, learn how to like analyze your soil and like almost like scientifically like give it what it needs, which is like some real next level stuff. And I'm like, it's beyond me at this point, but
yeah, it's a huge revelation. Just a few quick comments on that. Number one is I love, yeah, like how you're already beginning to make the distinction, you know, as you and I have already, I think, in past conversations, between just organic and true permaculture ways of like, hey, like, okay, organic's great. I mean, yeah, I'll definitely take my food without deadly toxic chemicals sprayed on it. Thank you very much. However, like, okay, we're over that, you know, like now where's the next step to actually growing something good? Because, you know, the issue of nutrient depletion and topsoil depletion is still an issue, and it's still an issue even in organic gardening and farming. So yeah, that's number one. And then yeah, just the like that revelation of the soil and really creating a microbiome and something that just cultivates that kind of life and nutrient density that you want. Is a whole like another level, and they're discovering that with people too, right? I mean, like, you know, we've discovered that hey, our gut health is actually important. In fact, it's like, you know, the foundation of all of our health, you know, for our whole body. So, you know, we thought we were really smart by just putting probiotics out there, and everyone's into probiotics, and it's kind of the new hot thing. A lot of people are taking probiotic supplements, but people are still sick. So, you know, like now we're just right on the verge, and you're going to see this, you know, but like we're on the verge of realizing, okay, like let's actually create, like in a situation in our guts that not like, you know, not only is something that we're adding to whatever, but like, you know, the probiotics, but we're creating an environment in the gut that actually houses the probiotics that we put in there. Because if you don't have a good system in your gut and a good structure in your intestines to actually hold the probiotics, then you're not going to benefit from the probiotics. You see what I mean? So
that's, yeah, like, crazy. You know, it's
yeah. So it's just adding that sort of texture, if you will, in the soil by adding that, that porosity and that organic material to the soil so it actually holds all the good stuff. Otherwise, you're just adding good stuff, but you're not making the most of the good stuff. In fact, it just kind of, you know, falls through the cracks, if you will. So, yeah, there's, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe on another conversation, but man, there's some really good stuff that we're turning on to here.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I would like to, like, so in your stomach, like, what do you have to eat more, like roughage, or what do people recommend for that?
One of the best sources for that is this guy named Dr. Zach Bush, and he, you know, he talks about basically no longer harming your gut, you know, which is really hard to do these days. But, you know, like the issue they're discovering is, like, for instance, is less to do with gluten and different things that we're intolerant to. It actually has more to do, like, the root issue is the glyphosate or Roundup and the chemicals that they spray on our stuff, because that really damages the lining of our intestines. So as soon as you take those substances away, then the body could actually begin to heal itself and restore the lining of the gut, so that's no longer, like, permeated. And then, like, you know, so things like gluten are no longer getting through the walls of the intestine. So and he actually has some supplement, I believe it's called Restore, which you know, ironically, and it all goes back to the soil, is actually like practically dirt water. It's like a tea made out of mined ancient dirt that has, like, it's not even full of probiotics. It just has this sort of structure. It's like humic acid that your intestines respond to, and those, they call it tight junctions in the wall, are actually healed, and it improves your whole gut health. And now suddenly your gut flora is actually doing much better, and it's, you know, like it comes alive again, and you didn't even add anything. It's just, you know, like this flora, small micro, living organisms are always available, but they don't really have a safe place to latch on to, if that makes sense. They need a good, healthy home. So, yeah, it's really focusing on just the actual gut itself, instead of just pumping the gut full of probiotics. That can be helpful, and people are doing that and receiving good results. But the end all be all is to actually improve the structure of the gut so that it can really hold these things well.
Yeah, and, you know, if you think about it, like, early humans, you know, probably didn't wash their food as well, and so they were, you know, we evolved getting a little more dirt in our guts than we get now. You know, everything comes wrapped in plastic and perfectly shiny.
That's exactly it, and they're even coming out with probiotic supplements that are full of SBOs, they call it, like soil-borne organisms. So soil organisms that are actually taken, you know, ingested, and, you know, people are finding great improvement in their guts. So,
wow. Well, I'm gonna go outside and eat some dirt after we get off the get off this interview. That's awesome. That's crazy. I'm going to look more into that. My mom's boyfriend just had some, he's going through some, whatever digestive shit. And it'd be interesting to give him some dirt. That would probably be really good. So, you know, like I said, when we, you know, we met up, in this PDC, you know, we really bonded over like the same things, you know. Everybody else was there for different reasons, you know, everyone was there for different reasons, but like we were like, you know, we love cooking with weird vegetables, like learning this stuff, geeking out on it, researching it is like, you know, so it was like, I'll just never forget that first meetup. We were just like locked in conversation for like an hour and a half straight. Just like, have you tried this? Yes, yes. And one of the plants that, you know, I had just started growing was lovage. And I didn't really know how to cook with it very well. And you were like, oh man, it's great when you blend it with a little bit of cream and, you know, try that. That's when it's at its best, like sprinkled on a chowder or something. And, and so, yeah, one of our favorite salad dressings now, we make a tahini dressing with lovage, and you just blend the lovage in with tahini. I love it, man.
So, awesome.
Yeah.
I love lovage.
Is there any other new plants that you're growing this year that you're excited about?
Yeah, so I'm actually looking right now at a plant, although it would be an annual where you're at, and of course here as well. But you would love this, Tim. It's called Vietnamese coriander. Have you heard of that one?
No.
Yeah, so, you know, cilantro could be a little tricky to grow, as you probably know. You know, I mean, you know, for some people they find it easy, but, I, you know, in Colorado with our, like, hellfire sun, you know, cilantro doesn't usually... you know, do well unless it's like nice dappled light. So a good alternative to that is this plant that practically grows like mint, and it's called Vietnamese coriander. And it's like, you know, it's not even a true coriander or anything like that, but it's a really good alternative. You know, it's like a slightly different note, but very similar taste to cilantro. And so, you know, one caveat though, like one issue is that it's like a semi-tropical plant. so it grows, it's growing really well in this greenhouse. But also indoors, if you have a real sunny window, I'd imagine it would grow really well, but you might want to look into that one because it's pretty fun.
It's very pretty too. It has nice little, purple and green on the leaves.
Yeah. You looking it up?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been fun. Trying to think what else here outside I've been doing. Really the same stuff, man. I mean, like lately in my yard here, I just started a small vineyard. I mean, small as in like, you know, 25 feet by 15 feet. There's like 8 vines, but I kind of wanted to just, I don't know, capture kind of that Northern California vineyard type of look. So I got those like little trellises. Yep. And I wired them up and, you know, like my whole deal is I want wine and like real wine, like wine that is not adulterated. And, you know, like, it would kind of follow the natural wines movement, which is just, you know, people who just want to see wine that's like grapes that are grown in good soil and then just fermented naturally, like not adding store-bought yeast, lab created yeasts or, but, you know, but just the natural yeasts that are on the skins of the grape to create a more complex, variable, but complex wine and, you know, no chemicals and nonsense added to it. So I'm really excited about that, you know, to give it a shot.
That sounds all. Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, you know how it is. It's just fun to geek out on this stuff and to just do it, you know, just to do it is
exactly.
Like, I'm at the point where it's like, I just enjoy doing it. Like it's weird. And like, I'm just like a moth to a flame. Like, I don't know why I'm just so driven to do these things. I just saw some people in Maine are doing a hardy kiwi vineyard, which,
come on,
you know, that's cool.
If I were you, I tried it again, as you and I have talked about. I thought I got one to do pretty well. I was like, okay, it'll be fine over the winter, but for some reason our winter just, you know, killed back most of the kiwi. I think it's just because it was so abrupt in the fall. So, but in Maine, yeah, I mean, man, like, yeah, they probably grow like weeds over there. And I'd be excited to hear about what the fruit tastes like right off the vine, man. It's, yeah, it just sounds like an awesome fruit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've only tasted it in France, but yeah, I got it growing. And yeah, maybe when I found a spot, I found a guy who has like 40 that my friend Aaron showed me, this person who sells Scion from Hardy Kiwi. So you can buy him for like $3. So,
awesome.
Yeah, he's got like 40 different cultivars. So maybe I could put you in touch with him and he could hook you up with, you know, something that's a little more, you know, desert hardy. Cause I know they're doing it in Oregon. Oregon's can be kind of desertish, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that would be awesome. I know Colomita, the one that's like variegated leaf. That one's like the most hardy and I haven't tried that one yet. So maybe that would be next on my seemingly endless, hopeless, you know, adventure of trying to get a hardy kiwi to grow and actually produce fruit in Colorado.
Oh man. Yeah. I don't even know if, cause I still have my house in Denver. I had a hardy kiwi vine that seemed to survive there. It'd be interesting to see if it's still alive. Well, okay. So, you know, the main reason the number one reason I reached out to you was because, you know, you have a climate battery greenhouse, you built it yourself. I think it cost you $175. Is that correct? Or something like that? 200?
Let's see. So Yeah, I actually have everything on a little document here. So,
well, before we get into like the super, before we get into the details, for those who don't know what a climate battery greenhouse is, can you kind of give a brief overview of what that is?
Absolutely. So, you know, some people call it a climate battery, others call it a subterranean heating and cooling system. But, you know, in general, you know, like if we zoom out, you know, like this, the simplest description of it is like it's an air movement system that utilizes the thermal mass and like the temperature holding capacity of the earth, of the soil, to help regulate the temperatures in the greenhouse that it's in. That is what a climate battery is in its simplest form. You know, you're just moving air through the soil, and that's why they call it subterranean, and then out another side or two. And as it comes out, it either comes out cooler or warmer, you know, to your liking, you know, to whatever your desired temperature or hopefully toward your desired temperature would be.
So, yeah, so basically, like, in the winter, it drives the cold air down under the soil, and then it warms it, and then in the summer, it does the opposite. So in a place like Colorado, it's like an incredible, you know, season extension tool.
Yeah, exactly. A very, very, very fun and easy example, you know, to describe what it is. Like, you know, as you know, in Colorado, you have like these temperature fluctuations, huge swings in temperature, even in one day. So, you know, like for instance, I have a Mediterranean style. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but kind of like, you know, a Mediterranean climate greenhouse, not a full on tropical, but Mediterranean climate greenhouse here. So, you know, if it's kind of a extra warm winter day and it's like 45 degrees and very sunny out in Colorado, well, that sun is going to heat my greenhouse like crazy. It's on the south side here. So, you know, it would not be unlikely that it would raise the temperature up past like 75 degrees in here. And it is winter, so I don't necessarily need or want it to be that warm in here in the middle of the winter. So this thing will kick off because it's got that dual thermostat at let's say, you know, any warmer than 55 or 60, it'll begin to kick off. And, you know, that the tubing here will pull the warmest air because it kind of sucks up the air from like a higher point in the greenhouse. So the warmest air and it drives it down into the ground through this series of pipes and out the other end. It'll come out, of course, naturally cooler. And then I'll just kind of, you know, keep everything more regulated during the day. Now, because it's Colorado, let's say that night it goes down to like negative 10 degrees, because that wouldn't be unlikely here either. It'll do the same thing. It'll kick out, let's say, you know, anything under 40, and all that kind of warm, you know, that thermal energy that was stored from before is now right there in the earth. And so now it's going to perform the same thing except on the warm side. So it's going to kind of come out warmer. And also, even if it wasn't storing, you know, the thermal mass so nicely, like, you know, that warmth, it's also just that ambient, like that sort of temperature below the frost line in Colorado that it kind of sustains. And I believe that's around 45 degrees. So it really helps to regulate your temperatures. And, you know, the same thing is true in one day in Colorado as like a whole year. You know, it's like the same system is sort of implemented. So in the summer, you know, I get a lot of cooling, and in the winter, I get a lot of warming.
That's awesome. And, you know, I mean, as you know, the weather in everywhere, but in Colorado especially, just becomes more and more erratic. And so, you know, this thing is a real nice bulwark against, you know, climate change.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So how, you know, how do you build it? Like what, like, you know, like walk us through, you know, how someone would go about like building one of these things. Like, I guess start with like what you need to build it, and then technically, you know, how you design climate battery aspect of it?
Sure thing. Yeah. If you don't mind, I'll just go ahead and start with like the story of how this thing came into being here.
That'll be awesome.
And just like what, you know, what I wanted. Yeah. So like, so I love the Mediterranean and I also love California. I just love the Mediterranean climate. It's just my, you know, my favorite, maybe it's just in my natural blood. I don't know, but, you know, I really wanted to replicate that, to replicate something tropical, you know, that like, you know, that would take a little bit more intervention and work and, you know, appropriate design. Although it can be done, but all I wanted to, you know, to do is just kind of create my own escape to California, my own sunroom, like right in my house, you know. So I have this 1900 old farmhouse, and you know, it's kind of quirky anyway, so I didn't mind it being quirky. So I really want to build these plan, like, you know, build out these plans to have an on-house greenhouse. So I wanted it on the house instead of separate from the house, because I could just walk out my back door and be in it. And also B, you know, like that north facing wall, or like, you know, whatever wall yet, like, you know, whichever direction it needs to face, like you are benefiting automatically from the thermal mass of your home. So whenever you open the door to come in, well, that's, you know, that's a benefit. I also wanted to, like in the middle of winter, if it was getting really warm in here, I want to be able to open my back door and actually benefit in my own home from the greenhouse, from that passive solar energy.
That's awesome. So, and does it work that way? Does it work that way? Like you can heat your house with your greenhouse a little bit, like kind of Earthship style?
Yeah, it kind of does. Not awesome. Not like a ton, you know, and not quite as much as I thought. However, absolutely, you know, I can just open my door and just, you know, kind of score a little extra warm air, you know, for that afternoon. So, you know, it's not that often that it heats up so much in here. And honestly, a lot of that is probably thanks to the climate battery. So, you know, like if I can have some sort of computerization of the climate battery that says, hey, when, you know, like when I want to open my back door, that shuts off because I want to actually maximize the heat in the greenhouse, you know, then that would be awesome. And side note, you know, like in commercial applications, they actually do have computerization of these climate batteries that really make it even, you know, that much more effective.
Oh, wow.
But yeah. So we had that benefit. So yeah, like, you know, I just really like the idea of creating an on-house greenhouse. I had a very low budget. I mean, not very, very low, but low. You know, like I was busy enough with work to have, you know, maybe a couple $1,000s to spend max. And as you know, a good quality, strong, sturdy greenhouse could be like, you know, if I were to get one of similar materials, built for me, it would probably be like $20,000, at least. So, you know, I really wanted to do it, you know, the most cost effective way possible. So my plan was to use recycled windows. And so I did. I was able to score some vintage farmhouse, which was very fitting for my house, windows off of Craigslist. People like, you know, virtually giving them away.
That's the one thing, no matter where you live, man, like Maine is like so stingy on Craigslist, but there's always windows.
Yes.
Tons of windows. Sorry to cut you off, but yeah. Sorry,
just... No. It's cool. Yeah. So I found like a whole bunch of windows, and you know, like from there, you know, you probably don't want me to get too much into the structural weeds here.
I think you should. I think let's not assume people, like, you know, people listening probably know as little as I do, you know, and I can barely put up a shelf. So I think it's better to assume total ignorance, you know, like, so yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So how I treated it, how I personally did it, and you know, people have their own ways. I knew that I wasn't going to get 30, 40 of the same exact sized windows. Like I was going to have all sorts of odds, you know, like odd shaped things and whatever. And I needed to put them together. And, you know, if you look on Etsy or, you know, even just Google image, like recycled window greenhouse, you know, I mean, like you'll see some ugly stuff out there. It just is. And most people don't care. I don't even care that much. If you don't care, then just, you know, like make it work however you need to. But I actually wanted to sort of improve the value of my home if I could, and keep it kind of pretty if I could. So I really maximized it by, structurally, I'll say this, like I loosely know how to frame like a wall, you know, like basically like, you know, out of 2x4 lumber, and like frame a wall. So I figured, okay, like I will create three walls, right? Because the fourth one is the house. And you know, I just needed to figure out like this, the size and shape, you know, like, basically the dimensions that I wanted. And then from there, it was just a matter of filling in those walls with windows. And that's exactly what I did. I was laying out windows flat on the, you know, on the grass, like on the ground, and just like, you know, seeing if I can, you know, roughly come up with those dimensions and keep them inside those dimensions. And so, you know, like I did, but sometimes I needed to literally put like extra 2x4s between, you know, chunks of it between windows and, you know, just things that made like, you know, to make it work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like so Tetris. Like Tetris.
I was just about to say, I kind of had to play Tetris a little bit.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But amazingly, I was actually like, I just happened to have a really good selection of windows, like ones that, you know, I was able to keep some sort of symmetry with, even though there were, you know, there were multiple sizes. And I remember you saw it, you know, like it's definitely characteristic. You know, there's a lot of weird character to it, but at the same time, it actually looks kind of nice, you know, like there was a little bit of symmetry, like, you know, I was able to find two of the same windows and put them, you know, like a mirror, like a reflection to like, you know, one on one side and one on the other. And then like the big one in the middle and just, to, you know, just kind of keep like a regularity to it. So, you know, that's what I did in a nutshell. I wish I could tell you like I have exact plans or anything, but it, you know, you just really can't because every greenhouse is going to vary in size, but just try to keep, you know, just think about the structural integrity of your greenhouse. In other words, you can't just have, you can't build a 10-foot by 15-foot wall and have like a 2x4 framework on the outside and then just fill it in with windows only and assume that's going to be structurally sound because it's not. You know, you like you still want those vertical you know beams to like support each other. You know, like mine are, you know, let's see, 32 inches apart. Approximately on one wall and another 24 inches apart, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, you definitely want some like structure to it, you know, because the windows themselves are obviously not going to have enough structural integrity to hold up something heavy. Also, like I wanted glass. So you could obviously do this all with what do they call those panels? You know, the greenhouse panels,
yeah, the
like
polycarbonate or whatever.
Yeah, polycarbonate. Yep, like, you know, double cell, you know, double wall, triple wall. That stuff is really effective, really awesome, but it's really expensive as well. And personally, I actually wanted glass. Like I'm a fan of glass. It looks great. It would look good on my old, you know, classic house here. And I just want like I want it to be clear. I do like that the polycarbonate will kind of filter and disperse the light, but I actually wanted like a natural direct light. So I didn't want it treated like argon treated glass or anything like that. That's another reason why I love the vintage windows because the sun just comes right through in most of its natural spectrum.
And did you find, you know, keep going.
So, and then the roof though, is obviously made, you know, not made with glass, because, you know, that wouldn't last a hailstorm here. So the roof, I actually just used old materials like, that corrugated clear roofing. And that was kind of expensive, but at least it was just the roof. And it's the heavy duty stuff, not the stuff that you get at Home Depot because in Colorado, you know, that would last like a year. So it's like thick, corrugated, clear fiberglass roofing.
So one of the things that I feel like I learned in Colorado is that, you know, in really sunny places, you don't want to have a glass greenhouse because it cooks everything. And so do you find that because you don't have a glass roof, that because the roof is of a different thing, that everything kind of works? Or have you had problems with things getting cooked in there?
So I can't say for like I can't speak from experience because I don't have a glass roof. I'd imagine that's true. I'd imagine the fact that the roof at least is very cloudy in nature that really helps to filter out the light a little bit. However, like if it was just clear glass, I think it would be fine. It's just that I would really need like extra good ventilation, and it would probably have a tendency to get even hotter quicker, especially with our sun in Colorado.
Right. Yeah. And just for the record, I thought your greenhouse was really nice. I didn't get the impression that I was in some ramshackle shit that I built and my wife's cursing, like what a shitty work job I did or something.
Right.
Like it seemed like it was done. It was done nicely.
A few additional little side notes that I have for now is like as far as the structure of it was that I also wanted to like in every single place I wanted to at least have two layers of glass. Like I never wanted there to be a spot in the greenhouse that only has one layer of glass. I always wanted two because when you have two, it's just that much better. When you have a double pane with a little air gap, like you're not going to lose the thermal energy as quickly and vice versa. So I either had these old windows that had a storm on them, or I had like two old windows that were the same size that were placed together as I was kind of like screwing them all into place, like creating for myself a double wall. Makes sense.
Oh wow.
Yep. Yeah. So I had these like basic windows, single pane. And I was like, okay, they're going together. That's just me. It just helped a lot. It'll still be helpful even if you have one, a single layer, but I'd imagine you'd really lose your energy very quickly. And then also, like another sidebar note, which is really, really interesting is my foundation. Like I actually did not want to make it like a permanent foundation. So I actually used the railroad ties. They are those genuine ones that, last like 100 years, that you get. So that technically, like I can't be nailed for like tax and permit and stuff. Like technically I could tell them that I can, disassemble this whole thing if I wanted to. And it's actually floating. So it's just railroad ties on the ground. And the whole thing is resting on these railroad ties.
That's awesome. Railroad ties are the really thick, whatever, half foot by half foot beams that are like 10 feet long or whatever. Is that what railroad ties are?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I guess my last question about the glass is, do the windows open? Do you have it? Did you build it so that like they could vent out if you wanted to or needed them to?
Absolutely. So, that's one of the things, if I can do it again, maybe I'd pay more attention to being able to do that even more. But none of these windows technically flip out or anything like that. They're very fixed. However, I do have a big, double pane glass door. That's like one of the only things I paid for. It was like $25 on Craigslist, someone's old door. So it was like one of those sliding door things. So as soon as you slide that door open, it's a big door. So you're getting a lot of ventilation there. And then, if you could picture it, like the roof had to be on an angle. You really want it to be, facing an angle towards the sun more. Again, if I could do mine, it would have been actually a harder angle. So it would face down, like it'd have a more of an angle so that it would hit the winter sun. Face it more than the summer sun. But again, it was my first time and I worked with what I had. But if you could picture it, in order to create that angle on the roof, there's like that space between the top of my two side walls and that angled roof. It's like this triangular, this trapezoidal, whatever you want to call it, space. So in that space, I created two solid flip out doors or like windows, if you will, on my own that are all insulated on hinges and those flip out. And it's good placement because it's they're at the highest two side points of the greenhouse. So like the hottest air that rises could at least get ventilated in the summer. It's still a challenge to keep it ventilated enough that ventilation is key for a successful greenhouse. So you know, if you're building one, just always remember that. Like, however you can vent well is really good, because you could always close things up if you need to. But, you know, when things are getting like 110 degrees, 115 degrees in there, you know, you really want to be able to open a lot of windows up. So,
so just for clarification, you say that, you know, you want it to angle, you know, because the sun is like during the winter season, you know, the sun is like, whatever, at 45 degrees, and in the summer it's at 90 degrees or whatever that is. So how would you angle it? How would you have angled your roof differently? Like, what's the, like, roughly, what do you think the angle is of it now versus, like, what would you have made it if you could do it over?
Definitely. Right now, it's probably at a, between 10 and 15, it's probably like a 15 degree angle. So it's not, you know, so it's more close, it's closer to the flat side of things, but just up a little bit. And if I could do it differently, I think I would do a harder angle, probably more like a 45 degree angle, maybe even like a 50-60. So that's really, you know, if you can imagine it, just facing that south sun in the winter when the sun is much lower, because then you maximize how much light you're getting, you know, which in turn is thermal, like it you know, transpires, like it turns into thermal energy. You know, like, you know, you really maximize your gains in the winter and minimize your heat gains in the summer, because, you know, like the more dead on that a wall is facing the sun, the more it absorbs. So right now it's actually angled probably perfectly to the summer sun, you know, so it's like really, really getting a lot of hot, you know, sun in the summer. And if I could do it again, it would, you know, like it would be facing away from the summer sun a little bit more.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but like one of my, I think it's Clausewitz or something, says like, you know, the best plans die on the battlefield. And it's like, as I'm listening to you talk about the angles and all this stuff, like I've read a ton about greenhouses, done a ton of research on them. And, it's still like, you know, just like that element of what you're talking about, like it, I think is like, you know, gets kind of lost on me. So I feel like, you know, when you get down to like this sort of level of detail, like really, in my opinion, like experience is the best teacher. Like, you know, the only, like, you know, you can read a million books and, you know, have like the perfect theories or whatever, but at the end of the day, you know, the best way you're going to learn how to do this stuff and the way you're going to be able to really do this well is to like, just do it, you know, have some good plans, have some good ideas, but to do it. And then like, you know, learn as you go, tweak as you go. And like, you know, your first greenhouse, maybe that's just your first greenhouse, and maybe all the lessons you learn on that one, you know, fold into your second one, and, you know, and like, and so it's like, it can seem like daunting or whatever, but really, I don't know. I feel like sometimes you got to just do it, you know?
Definitely. There are just so many little pieces, you know, pieces of the puzzle, pieces of science that go into, you know, this thermal heat exchange, you know, like really maximizing everything about your greenhouse. You know, I mean, there are little things out there, like, you know, like create more insulation on the rear 20% of your side walls, or, you know, just little things that like, you know, would really help a lot, you know. One more thing before we get into the ins and outs of the actual climate battery, you know, that's worth mentioning here, is that I also have maximized some of my gains by implementing 55 gallon like vinyl or plastic barrels or drums, as you'd call them, as I'm sure most people have seen, these oil drums or water drums. 55 gallon, I have two that are black, and just filled with water and just sealed. So, you know, I'd heard that water, because of the hydrogen, is one of the best, you know, storing mediums of heat, if not like the best on the earth. So I figured, okay, like, let me have two big, masses, if you will, you know, like vessels of water that are black, and they're like covered at the top with plants. Or like another thing of water, which I'll get to in a second. So that, you know, like the black units are not absorbing as much of the sun in the summer from overhead. But in the winter, I try to keep the sides totally exposed so that, you know, like that thermal heat exchange is happening on, you know, like in the black units. And then on top of one of them, I have a white, you know, drum, the same type of drum, but white. So that it does not absorb heat, and that is filled with water, with like a little like drip system coming out of it, like a little like spigot conversion on it, and that just feeds into like a gravity fed drip system, and that's why I put it on top of one of them, so it's kind of high up. So yeah, having these vessels of water really helps also to regulate the temperatures by, you know, just storing whatever, you know, like nighttime and daytime temperatures are in the greenhouse.
That's awesome. You're not collecting from the roof, are you?
No. I think I was telling you about that. That is a project that I designed from the beginning. I still have not gotten to, you know, and just to review that real fast is, yeah, you know, like for the sake of those listening, it's,
well, especially I really want to build in, a, I'm sorry to cut you up, especially in like drier southwestern, you know, brittle environments, like water is such an important consideration when you're doing this stuff, you know, whereas like other parts of the country that are so wet, like where I'm at right now, like people don't really think about water. It's just everywhere.
Definitely. And even furthermore, like, even, you know, even if you are in a place with water, like it's always an awesome, you know, natural resource for good quality water. So like, even if water, you know, retention is not an issue in my area, like I would still rather see my plants be you know, watered with rainwater that's free of all that chlorine, fluoride, chloramine, and all that other junk that like kills the microbes in the soil, and it's harmful to the plants. You know, like I'd rather them actually be watered with natural rainwater. So yeah, my, you know, the plan eventually is to create a gutter system that basically, like, you know, it's a regular gutter, but then it feeds through some PVC that comes into the greenhouse and then fills up that top container that I was just telling you about. And then it just has an overflow that goes back out. So yeah, like I'm still driven to do that. And, you know, like hopefully one of these years when I'm a little slower with work, I can get something like that going.
But yeah, you know, that's what I mean. It's like, you know, with all these projects, it's like you have a million ideas and then, like, you know, you only get to implement like the most important ones, and then you can look forward to, you know, adding your irrigation system, you know, whatever, whenever you get to it.
Definitely. And one more little piece, like while we're talking about thermal energy, you know, one thing that'll be helpful to people to remember is, you know, like how back there we just said that water is one of the best, you know, conductors and storing, you know, liquid, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, mediums, like on the planet. Well, plants are like full of water. So like, you know, to really help maintain a good, you know, air consistency or temperature consistency is, you know, in your greenhouse, have a lot of plants, you know, like just really fill it with a lot of, like, just lots of life, lots of green plants, because that's going to create that shade, or that storing capacity, you know, in the winter, and just all that, like, you know, like, I'm realizing that things are improving, as these plants in the greenhouse, as you saw before, when we first got on, you know, these like fig trees and a few things in here are just getting huge. So, you know, like the more you have as far as plants, that'll also, like, they will work together to help keep each other, in, you know, in a better environment. So pack up your greenhouse with lots of plants. If you got this big open greenhouse and just not that many plants in proportion to the volume or, you know, the cubic space of your greenhouse, then you're really going to have, you know, many more issues with, you know, temperature extremes, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So just like throw a shelf in there and whatever, put some freaking kale hanging from the roof or like whatever, like anything.
Definitely use your vertical space. Just fill it up, you know? And then it's fun because it's why you have it in the first place. Right. So it's good.
That's awesome. Well, before we talk about the climate battery itself, which is like, you know, the crux of this, that's like just so cool. Because like when I walked into your, space, it was, you know, early summer, and I was just struck by like like, you know, Colorado's so dry, but in your greenhouse, there was just this cool, damp air blowing, and it was just a very pleasant place to be. Yeah, so it just blew my mind. It was so freaking cool. But before we talk about the climate battery, can you talk about, you know, Colorado is, or Denver area, Lakewood, Wheat Ridge, wherever you live, is zone 5B, or should say it's between zone 5 and 6 because it's constantly changing. But it's mostly 5. So in that, which is like, you know, a huge portion of the country is zone 5. So, I mean, that says a lot, but it also says nothing. In zone 5, like, you can only grow certain things. Whereas, like, in your climate battery greenhouse, you're able to really grow stuff that you could never think of growing outside in Colorado. So can you talk about some of the things that you're growing in your, climate battery greenhouse?
Absolutely. Yeah. And Denver, I believe it's, what is it? A semi-arid continental climate. And what's funny about zone 5 in the Mountain West is just it's just craziness, you know, like technically you and I are very similar zones, but you know, like, as you know, Tim, it's like, you know, Colorado is very moody and the fluctuations are just incredible. So, you know, it's actually hard for that USDA climate zone system to even accurately define, you know, like our climate, as far as like, you know, what hardiness zone, because it's just all over the place. But yeah, exactly. 5B. Lately, it's been 6A, apparently. They just changed to Wheat Ridge, Colorado, where I live, to 6A. But it's just, you know, it's really harsh. So, in here, like I said, so I wanted to capture a Mediterranean climate. And I just wanted those plants I love, namely figs, because I'm Greek and Italian, and I love my figs. If anyone has it, I mean, if when you think of figs as like fig Newtons or even dried figs, like, you're missing out. You know, like, just a fresh, ripe, almost overly ripe fig is just absolutely incredible. It's like one of my favorite fruits to eat. So that and guavas. I just love them all. So I could grow figs. Finally, in ground, by the way, and we'll talk about that in a minute, about the benefits of having bare ground in your greenhouse instead of a floor. Don't let me forget that, because it's huge. So in ground, I also have in ground citrus. So I really wanted to grow citrus, and so I have been growing citrus successfully. Especially the slightly more cold hardy citrus. So I'm looking at a Satsuma Mandarin orange right now, which is the cuties, like those little clementine easy peels. Right now it's got like, let's see, it's got like 35, 40, you know, fruit on it, which is really awesome. So those will be ready around. Yeah, I know. It's a good year for that. So around winter, those should be going. I have blood orange, which is also kind of a cold, hardy citrus, as well as kumquat, which is like my favorite now. Just amazing. Citrus explosion in your mouth. Just amazing fruit. I just put that in the ground. So the citrus does great in here. I also have pomegranate, which is like really trying to take over the whole greenhouse. It's awesome. It's growing really well. And it's blooming for the first year here, so I should get fruit this year, if not, definitely next year. I also love persimmon. Persimmon, you might be able to grow a hardy American persimmon, but around here, even if it's cold hardy enough, it just doesn't do well with our weird, you know, bipolar springs, you know, and our late frost. So I have a nice Fuyu Japanese persimmon in the ground that I put last year. And it's really, putting on a lot of growth this year. I have aloe in the ground, a couple of huge aloe specimens here. So those are really fun to have. Just some fun stuff like bougainvillea, because I really wanted to create that sort of California Mediterranean scene. I have rosemary.
Bougainvillea, what's that? Is that just like
bougainvillea ornamental? Is that? Yeah, all ornamental, just because I'm a Mediterranean geek. I wanted to create that sort of environment. If you see those classic pictures of like Greece or Italy or Spain or France with like that, those like hot pink to reddish flowers growing over people's doorways, at their home, in, with their stucco and tile roof homes, that's know, that's very much bougainvillea.
Nice.
And in fact, I actually have that, you know, making its way up over my door. So pretty fun. So things like that. I also have an olive in an old pot, some pineapple guava, which is like kind of related to guava, but it's not guava. It's like its own thing from South America. It's semi cold hardy. It can get down to like 20 degrees. See, most of these plants in here could actually get down to like, the weakest ones I have in here can't go below, much below freezing. But if it's a really cold year, I can move those inside. But the rest, figs, pomegranates, even some of the most cold hardy citrus can go down to around 20 degrees. So I'm okay with it going down. Yeah, I think the coldest it's ever gotten in here is like 26, 25, which is actually okay with me. I'm growing Mediterranean plants that actually need a dormant season. They need a little bit of a winter. So they lose their leaves, many of them. And spring in here, I'd say, is like February. It's very, very similar to like, you know, central California, I'd say, if I had to pick a similar climate. So mission accomplished.
That's awesome. Yeah. The only thing I'll throw out there for persimmons is like the early jewel. I don't know if you've looked into that cultivar, but that is the kind that I tried to buy this year. It didn't come through, but that is, they say, the best for short growing seasons. And, you know, maybe if it was planted on the side of the house that, was shaded properly early in the yes. spring, that maybe you could get it. So if you do end up looking at getting a persimmon for outdoors, check out the early jewel.
It's awesome. No, it's a good geek moment. You should text me that. So I'd love to look that up. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the most expensive tree I bought this year. I wanted it to be like the centerpiece of my yard, and like I don't even really like persimmons that much, but I was like, I just thought it'd be pretty. We got a medlar too.
Nice.
And we wanted to have the two next to each other, but they never sent me my persimmon. And then they tried to send me something else. I was like, fuck that shit. I want my money back, you know? That's so inspiring. I mean, that's crazy that you're growing guava too. I didn't know that.
Yeah, pineapple guava. Like, so regular guava is actually more tropical. It really doesn't even like to go below 45. So I actually have that in my dining room because I have, as I think you saw, like I have these huge south-facing windows. So it kind of lucked out as far as the house is concerned with that. In fact, that's actually about to put on some blooms too. So, you know, that's another little side note. You just, like, you maximize everything, like, you know, what you have, you know, like you work with what you have. Like for me, I'm really capitalizing on the fact that I have these south facing windows. So there, is kind of like my mini tropical greenhouse. You know, I grow guavas there and pineapple. I like to just slice the top off of a pineapple, stick it in moist soil. It usually roots, you know, you can put it in water as well. And, Kirsten and I, like my wife and I have enjoyed ripe, perfect pineapples, like, you know, like right off of our windowsill. So like, and they are amazing, man. It's like just getting it like straight off of a plant, like, you know, the Hawaiian plantain, dude. It's like, I mean, it was a little smaller, but man, it's a ripe pineapple.
That's, you know, insane. It's like,
yeah, and it's an awesome conversation starter. People come over for dinner, they're like, what? Is it a pineapple? Because it's, you know, it takes like 9 months to fully ripen. So, you know, like I have this plant with this huge pineapple right in the middle of it. So a lot of fun. One other thing I was going to say, as far as the plants that I grow in here, it's also great for seed starting because it's like warmer in here earlier. So I start my seeds in here. A lot of my cuttings, I have a mulberry cutting right now. Like taking root in a little plastic cup and three grape cuttings. So things like that. And then also, greens, you know, like, so even though things die back because it's Mediterranean, in the winter, in the same season, I can grow cold, like, you know, cold loving greens all year round, but especially in the winter. So like lettuces, lots of arugula, you know, I'll just kind of come out here and pick these things, parsley, so in the middle of winter, it just makes a wonderful, if you can keep it from getting below 25, even 20 degrees, you can still grow these greens all winter. So,
right. And one thing I'll just to give a visual image to people. You know, I mean, anybody who's familiar with food forestry will understand this, but like when I, cause I've been in there and like, you know, around the base or around the bottom, like, you know, you have your fruit trees growing, but then right in the soil, like, you know, in front of that south facing window, there's just all these greens just planted directly into the soil. So it's like, you just have like a little salad garden just kind of at the base of all this stuff. And so you can just go in there with scissors anytime you want to, you want some herbs or, and you have like a huge rosemary in there too.
I do.
Which
yes,
is like,
I know,
so you, such some nice California shit. Like everybody wants a big rosemary like that in their, you know, front patio room. You know, it's amazing.
Definitely. And in fact, I have to like cut this thing back, but it's getting big, but you know what, you know what cutting back means, like it ends up in my kitchen cabinet. So it's perfect.
That's awesome. But yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, and it's like easy to skip over like the simple things like rosemary and arugula, but it's like, that's the stuff we eat, you know, that's the stuff we use. So
exactly. Exactly.
It's not as sexy as a pineapple guava, but hey, I don't know. Rosemary's, you know, pretty sexy. So
I love rosemary.
All right. Well, so yeah, I mean, you know, maybe we can get some good photos of, what it looks like in there to accompany this.
Yeah, maybe it's worth noting. Like, you know, I do have a little YouTube channel, you know, I really don't do that much on it, but it's called The Colorado Garden. And you know, if you check that out, you know, there are some, earlier, you know, like I think the latest update on it, I think was 2016, maybe 17, but you know, there are a few early videos that just show the whole greenhouse at all different angles. I do explain a little bit, like obviously I don't go into the exact plans, but yeah, if you really want to geek out on it and to see the thing that we're talking about, you can, you know, you can check that out. And then, you know, a few updates, like in consecutive years, like a few years later, it shows things in the ground and stuff like that. So
that's awesome. I didn't know you did that.
Yeah. It's, you know, yep. It was fun. Yeah. And like, if you want, I can, I'm not sure how it works on, you know, on your website or whatever, but if you want me to send you a link later to one of the videos or whatever, I can do that.
Yeah. That'd be great. That'd be great. Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's one of those things where like, you know, people make these videos, they start these YouTube channels, and then like, you know, once you're once people get really into it, it's like at a certain point, they just stop making video updates. And it's like, you know, the viewers wondering like, oh, I guess they must have just, you know, given up or stopped doing it or whatever. But it's like, no, actually, like, you know, when you're really into, when you really, really get into it, sometimes you don't have time to, you know, make a video every 2 weeks or whatever.
It's exactly it. I just do a lot of different things in my life. And so, you know, I get busy. So, you know, but these things are, they've been pretty self-sustaining, which is really awesome. I guess that's like, you know, one of the goals, right? So, yeah, you know, like they're just kind of doing it on their own, and they're like, this greenhouse is constantly improving. And then I kind of look back, I'm like, oh shoot, I could have shared that, but you know.
Oh well, you know, sometimes sharing isn't caring. You know, we're being like conditioned to work every second of our lives, and you know, it's like it's good to participate in the mass culture of education, but at the same time, it's like, you know, that's the thing I struggle with is like, you know, how much shit do we really need? How much shit is just filling the world, and how much we want to contribute to that noise?
No, exactly it. And, you know, like, for me, it really is about relationships and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, sharing is like one of the more fun and meaningful things I do love to do. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you live in like in my area, then yeah, like hit me up and I'll, you know, get you in on a tour and we'll just, you know, I'll give you some vegetables to pick, you know. It's just, yeah, I mean, like I this is one of my favorite things to do, is just have people over and check things out. And, you know, if I could be of any benefit to them, and then vice versa, I love taking tours of other people's stuff and learning the things that you know, that that they've gained out of their own experiences. So
yeah, it's cool. It's cool. Yeah. It was one of the, you know, one of the things that was cool is like through the permaculture class, I'm sure, like, you know, we were just students in there, but I'm sure whatever, like, you know, five or six different people got to, you know, come over your house at different times because we were learning about these things in class. And then it's like, yo, I've got one. Come on over my house. Check it out. It's awesome.
Yeah. They sure did. Yep. That was a lot of fun. Yeah. That was the highlight of it, is just sharing. Yep.
Okay. Well, so we've talked about the plants you're growing, the glass, and probably the most, you know, crucial, or one of the most crucial and complicated and, like, whatever, magical parts of this thing is the climate battery itself. I don't even know if that's, like, the word that you would use for it, but can you describe what that system is like that pushes the air and, like, you know, how it's
definitely
done?
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. So let's get into it. Okay, so the climate battery or subterranean heating cooling system, we described, you know, kind of in general what it does. Basically what you want to do is, like I said, you have two endpoints, you know, like one that basically inhales the air, like, you know, it sucks in the air, and one that blasts out the air, like, or exhales the air. And then you want enough space in between, like linear space, which I'll get into in a second, for that air to pass through. One thing to note is that when you have a climate battery in, like, in your greenhouse, you probably don't want much of a floor, because, like, you know, you're going to be using the soil, the earth beneath, and while you can use the soil from outside, because I've seen that done, like, you know, people will have like, you know, like the pipes run like outside from like one area of their yard to another. And I believe if you Google, what is it, like citrus in the snow, like, you know, this old guy, like, you know, this old gentleman, like really neat guy, he discovered a way to do this, and he doesn't even call it a climate battery. He doesn't even know what that was, or at least when he was building it. But you know, like, this is, so, you know, there are many ways of doing this, but the best way is to use your own sort of ground, like inside the greenhouse, to dig into and install your sort of pipe work or tubing, in order to start circulating that energy. So you're not plan on having a floor, or I guess if you wanted to, you can install a floor after you've installed, you know, the pipe work. I think that floors are just a waste. You know, like, why not have ground so that, like, you know, you have, like, it's almost like going out into the garden of your yard, except with a wonderful, you know, protecting roof over it. You can really benefit from and have your plants benefit from, like, the raw soil and growing in the earth, instead of in essence, like, in a pot, like, you know, on top of the floor. Like, I think, like, science hasn't even begun to cover, like, all the benefits of even just, like, you know, growing in the ground, versus not in the ground. I'm still a fan of hydroponics and aquaponics and all that, but I still say there's nothing like good, real, raw soil. And those benefits even include things that we're just coming onto, like earthing or grounding, whatever, and negative charges versus positive charges and things like that. So, you know, like, to me, like, the benefits of having raw ground inside your greenhouse are endless. And like I said, I got awesome, you know, results growing plants right in the ground inside my greenhouse. I'll pause there just in case you have anything to insert.
No, I mean, that sounds great, man. I mean, one of the was you were talking about the guy growing the citrus things. It just, as, like, an aside, like, one thing that people do out here is they have, like, tubes of water running with, like, in like hot manure, and they heat greenhouses. They're growing, like, tomatoes in the winter using that instead, which is crazy to me.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. I'd read about the compost and manure trick too. And I think that's just fantastic. I haven't done that in here just because I don't really have that much space. I don't even know where I'd put that. You know, like, I've filled it up with, you know, so many plants at this point, but I really do love that idea in theory. I'm sure it works well as long as you keep up, you know, with the greens and browns and, you know, keep that bacterial reaction continuously going. So it is worth mentioning that, like the space that I had to work with, I actually do have some floor. So, you know, like when you walk out the back door here, there is like a, I want to say it's probably about a 10, like nine or 10 foot by 6 foot slab, because it's just a normal back door to a home, you know, so it has like a little like sort of slab to step onto. So I knew that I'd be a little bit limited because, like, you know, like I wasn't about to rent like a Caterpillar or whatever to, like, you know, break up the slab and do excavation work. However, like, I wanted the greenhouse, like, circumference, like outer borders to surpass where the slab was and have enough, like, you know, in the raw ground beyond the slab to still implement one of these climate batteries. So what I did, like, if you could picture this, you know, around the slab on the sides, I only have about 2 feet. From like the edge of the slab to each wall. So I wasn't about to utilize that, because it would just make for like a weird, climate battery design. But on the south side, on that one side, that's opposite my house, I have about like 4.5-5 feet from the edge of the slab, to that south wall. So I figured, okay, like I'm going to put the climate battery in there. And, you know, when you Google this and look up videos, like, you'll at least see what we're talking about as far as the rough design of the, you know, the climate battery. But what they'll usually do is, like, say I didn't have a slab here, you know, they would just have, you know, one main out or in on one side and one on the other. And then the tubes that connect the two will just kind of run along the whole surface area of the soil, it was like within the greenhouse, and that's brilliant, but I couldn't do that because the slab is in the way. So I actually went further down and I dug this huge trench before I even framed up the greenhouse. But I put those railroad ties there just so I had, like, you know, like already my outer area, and I knew where the walls would be. Like in that 5 foot space, I dug, like, you know, I guess 4 feet, you know, like, so one, like 6 inches in on both sides, and then four feet down, deep, so that I can have vertical layers of these. You usually want vertical layers anyway. Like most designs will say, you know, your first layer of tubing or your surface most layer of tubing should be at least 1 foot underground, and then maybe if you have one underneath it, you know, like 1 foot underneath that. Well, I did four layers all the way down. So like the first, like, you know, the bottom most one is 4 feet down, and then the next at three, the next at two, and the next at one.
Oh,
so
okay.
I had four. Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, let me cut you off right there. So, okay, so that's not how I understood these things to work. I what I thought you had was like a perforated drain pipe, just one of them below the frost line. But so what you're saying is, so you've dug down 4 feet, and then every foot you have one of these perforated drain pipes running along the side, running side to side?
Yeah. Yes, except like that. So the one, let's say at 4 feet depth, you can have one perforated pipe, you know, doing that. But I actually have four, like side by side. So, and then they're separated with like a foot gap between each one, side to side. And then
okay, so it's
and then
side,
I filled it in with.
So it's side to side, not one at 4 feet, one at 3 feet, one at 2 feet. It's like going up and down. They're going side by side.
Exactly. Picture this.
Okay.
You want enough exposure and surface area on the perforated piping to like, you know, like maximize the thermal gains or losses, like in your air. So one way to do it, like, so it's actually all mathematic, you know, like mathematical. Like I saw the formulas before they took it off the websites. You know, like I said, you know, like as you and I discussed, like, you know, the revolutionary guys, you know, the guys who invented this thing, you know, they were sharing all their plans, and then they realized that, hey, like I can make a living doing this. And you know, so they began to actually consult with huge, you know, let's say like for instance, you know, tomato greenhouse growers in like Australia that hired them to come. and consult and help build these things. And, you know, apparently they were saving them like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month in heating bills. So, like all I have to say is at one point there were a couple of websites that had these formulas, that at the time I wrote down and I figured out how much linear footage of tubing that I needed, in proportion to the cubic feet, like to the cubic dimensions or volume of my greenhouse, if that makes sense. And here's a little thing. It's like say you know, like you put in this formula, which, like, you know, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but you know, and you realize that, like, okay, in order for me to really make a dent and like, you know, have a good ideal temperature situation in my greenhouse, I'm seeing that I need 250 feet of this tubing. Like, one thing you do is you could literally just have one tube that connects both cylinders, you know, like the out and the in, and it's just doing like a squiggly, you know, or like, right, you know, an S shape, in the ground of your whole greenhouse. Or, you know, you could have 250 feet of tubing, but you have many cuts, if that makes sense. And it's actually much more efficient to do it that way. So in other words, instead of like one 250 foot tube, you have 25 10 foot tubes, you know, for lack of better, like, you know, but it just depends on the positioning of your two ends, your two plenums or cylinders. But, you know, you figure out what you need, and it's better to have more lengths of tubing. Mind you, though, they have to, like, you want to have them about the same length each. You know, they shouldn't vary much, because then, like, you know, like the air is going to want to follow the least resistance. So you'll get more air, like unproportional, like, you know, it'll be flowing through the shorter tubing than the longer, if that makes sense. So you want all the tubes to be around the same length, but it is more efficient to have many tubes rather than one tube. And also, you know, if something goes wrong somehow, you know, with that one tube being blocked, well, you know, like, there goes your whole system.
Well, so what's the rough formula? Like, let's say you have whatever 100 square, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. 40 square feet,
definitely,
or something.
Yeah, definitely. Let's go over that. And I do encourage you, you know, like when you're listening to this, just check out, like, you know, because it's really hard to describe these things until we see some pictures, some video. You know, check out my video just so you can, like, see the area of ground that I worked with, so you could, like, properly, hopefully, picture these things. But, you know, like, you can see lots of videos of people, like, sharing what it looks like to install these things, just not enough, you know, sources that actually spell out what to do. And that's why that's why Tim's podcast is so awesome, because we're about to do that. So, yeah. So, okay. So my greenhouse, just, like, to give you some ideas here. Well, first of all, when I wrote down those formulas and copied, like, the whole thing down, as far as the proper proportions, somehow between now and then I deleted them. So like, I apologize, everyone. Like, I no longer have those. That's what happened. You know what happened? I copied the link for myself and just put that in my documents, so that every time I wanted to just check out the, like, you know, the formula and just make sure I'm doing it right, I'd click on the links. Well, a couple of years later, I've realized that those links are no longer active. They shut down the sites. So, however, like, you know, lucky for us, like, I can give you the proportions of what I did so that you can, you know, recreate that in any situation, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So in essence, like, yeah, I don't have the exact formulas as they wrote them, but I sort of have a rough idea. Whereas if I needed to do it again, I could look at what I did and the few things I did save, and I can replicate it.
Yeah. So just build an extra 20% of pipe. Take your formula on your stuff, and then just add another 20% onto it, and everything's good.
That's exactly it. So here's what I got, and I'll go a little slow, but, you know, because I'm from New York and I still talk like a New Yorker. My greenhouse is approximately 14 feet by 11 feet by 9 feet. That's a rough cubic footage of 1,386 feet, cubic feet. So 1,386 cubic feet, like that, like, you know, that's a really important number because, like, you know, you just want to figure out the rough volume of air that you need to move. And so you need to figure out the cubic foot dimensions of your area. So using the formulas that were given by this guy that called himself Sonny John, I think, you know, he was one of, if not the creator of like what we know as the climate battery, or at least one of the revolutionaries. Given those formulas, I estimated that I needed approximately 225 linear feet of subterranean tubing. So whatever, like, you know, if you want to punch into Google calculator or whatever, you know, there's some proportion for you already. Like, I had 1,386, so almost 1,400, you know, square feet. With that, I needed around 225 linear feet of that tubing.
So that's basically like 6.16. So for every 6 feet of cubic space in your greenhouse, you want 1 foot of pipe. Approximately.
Perfect. Yeah, I appreciate. Yeah, and no, I appreciate that you're in front of your computer. I'm in front of my phone. So, but that sounds.
Yeah, teamwork that makes dream work, man. Right. Teamwork makes dream work.
Right. Right on, man. Yeah. So yeah, that sounds about right. So yeah, whatever you're doing there. And you know what? I did in preparing for this. I said. Here's what I wrote. I said, so take 15 to 20% of the cubic foot number, and that is how many feet of tubing you ideally want underground.
That's awesome. I mean, because I just thought it was just like one little pipe. So it's good to know that there's a little more to it than that.
Definitely, because I have a 14-foot span from one end to another. For like, you know, I'm going to call them, they usually call them a plenum, you know, which is just a cylindrical thing for the tubing to connect to, you know, which you'll see in all the pictures, you know, or, you know, in videos and all that stuff. And you'll see it in my video, like the ductwork that I put that comes out. So I have 14, no, not even, I'm sorry, probably about 12 feet, 11 feet, 10 feet, something like that, between, you know, like from end to end. And yeah, if I just had one piece of tubing that was going from one end to another, I mean, sure, it would benefit just a tiny bit, but it wouldn't, you know, I like, you know, now I have. Yeah, like now I have like hundreds of feet of tubing, you know, so like, you know, that's a lot of air movement and therefore a lot of energy storing, or like, you know, passive energy happening, you know, a lot of temperature is being picked up by all that air moving.
So I feel like the last component from my, you know, outsider perspective, is like that's like beyond that, like that, like technical piece that's like a challenge is like the actual device that automates the when the fan turns on at the certain temperatures.
Definitely.
Can you talk about how that works and what that is?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? I'll just keep, if you don't mind, like I'll go ahead and just go right down this whole document that keeps spilling a little more out, because it is worth noting that. So here's the deal. I calculated that I needed 225 linear feet. Well, I couldn't make that happen because I dug down 4 feet and, you know, I'm talking like a silly man with a shovel, you know, like I didn't have like a, you know, like some sort of machinery to do that. So that took like, it probably took a better part of a month because I was like, you know, busy with work and stuff. So I was able to have 4 layers of 4, let's say around 10-foot tubing, which I think I'm going to mention in a second here. But yeah, like I was able to get about 120 linear feet of tubing. So like, if you do the math, that's like not much more than half of the tubing that I really ideally wanted, based on Sonny John's, formulas. However, it's still working pretty darn well. So, you know, like, again, if I did not have that slab in the way, like I would have easily been able to do that. But and the only reason why I was able to gain 120 feet of tubing was because I dug so far down. But I would have had to dig like, you know, another 3-4 feet down in order to make that happen, and it was just not going to happen.
Damn.
But with that, you know, again, like, you know, as you and I mentioned, there's always a better, a more ideal way to do things, and you learn from your mistakes. But that really, you know, like I just worked with what I had. That wasn't even a mistake. That was a planned mistake. And you know, it still does pretty darn well. I barely ever have to intervene except on the absolute coldest few to several nights of the whole winter, with one of those, it's like an oil filled radiator, because they're pretty safe and very effective and not like that high power for what you get. So, right. Like this past winter, I think I had to do that like literally like once, because it wasn't that bad of a winter.
Okay. So we were talking about the, like the specific technical stuff of like, the automated air, transfer kind of stuff. So like what, yeah. Like what are the formulas for that, for like how much, you know, air you need to be pushing, and how does the, like the automated temperature regulator thing work, or I don't know what, however you would describe those things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was just, we're on, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I was just breaking down the fact that, you know what, I actually used a little above a half of the total linear footage that was actually recommended, by those who basically invented this system. And yet it's still been very, very, very effective. So, I have about 120 linear feet of tubing when I needed 225 around. But again, all good. It's working. So just work with what you have. You know, I had a big slab in my way, but you know, like if you don't have the slab, then go for the total amount needed. My tubing is in, like I said, multiple flat rows of four, 10-foot lengths that are spaced approximately 12 inches apart on all sides. That's kind of key. That was very recommended. So if you can, you know, it's like, say you're laying like a row of like 10, lines of that perforated tubing, you want them to be at least a foot apart. And then ideally, like on the next one that's going to be above that, after a little backfill, if you can offset them so that in all angles, you know, they're like maximized, spaced apart. So instead of like, you know, the next row being directly over the other, if you could offset it so that, that they kind of fall in between, in their alignment, that's even better. But either way, if you go to any tube, if you go to the profile of any tube, you know, in the tubing, you want it to always be 1 foot apart from the next, but I'd say about 12 inch, like 1 foot radius from one to another, at least.
Do you have to worry about the roots from the trees growing through those pipes or anything?
No, because if you do get the perforated ADS tubing, which I think I named that in a minute, I think I go over the actual, I will name all the parts to this thing and where you can get them and all that stuff. But if you do go with the perforated ADS tubing, you do have to remember like it's air movement. So, like if the roots were to try to poke through that or get through the space, like they're basically going to be air pruned. Like, you know, they're not going to, like, you know, there's going to be no soil or water really for the roots to get themselves into. So as far as I can tell, it's not the same as like plumbing, you know, or, clay or, you know, like pipes that we have in our yards that, you know, we could have that issue with, because the roots are just going to like hit air and they're not going to want to keep going, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. That's awesome.
And the really cool thing that I heard is another side benefit of this system is that when the air moves through this tubing, it actually very often creates condensation on the outside of the piping, which is now in the soil. So it actually helps, you know, because a lot of times in a greenhouse, you'll have humidity and moisture issues, this helps actually mitigate those issues as well. It sort of absorbs a lot of the humidity in the air and puts it down into the roots where it's actually needed with these plants. So, I can't attest to that because I'm not down there in the soil, you know, in the pipes. But that's another benefit that I've heard of. So
really for places that are more humid, you know, like Maine or the Midwest or something, or the Pacific Northwest, you know, where mold is like a huge problem, this could help.
Exactly.
Mitigate that. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty awesome. So, in regards to air movement, I calculated that you want to move, I think this might even be a direct quote from these websites before they took them down, but you want to move a minimum of 128. Well, no, it's not a direct quote. I'm sorry, but when I applied the formula for my greenhouse, I wanted to move 128 cubic feet per minute, so CFM. So, like when you look up fans, you will like you know they'll almost always be rated, but like they'll rate the CFM. But a minimum of 128 cubic feet CFM with my 1386 cubic foot greenhouse. So 128 CFM with 1386. So again, you can kind of
take 10%.
Yep. That's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah, you take approximately 10%, or maybe just a little less than that, of the cubic foot number, and that is a CFM fan you want to use.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
This is my friend Evan. He's talking. He's telling us about how to build a greenhouse.
Yeah, it sounds like he's really listening. He's getting some out of this one.
Oh, yeah.
So, and for me, what worked, like, you know, that came out of the, you know, the plenum that I built, like the plenums that I built, like I wanted to use 8-inch ductwork because it's pretty standard, you know, use that like in homes, like just that like regular aluminum ducting. So, like for the fan, if get this, all I needed was it's called a corded inline air duct booster fan, and it's made by this company called Suncourt. It's one word, Suncourt, and you get it like Home Depot and stuff like that. And you know they will have different speeds and CFMs, I'm pretty sure, but you know the one that I needed was like $45, and I decided to get the variable speed controller just in case I wanted to control the speed of the fan, because that actually does come into play. Like, you know, how fast do you move that air? Do you want it really fast? Well, if you go really fast, it's going to move more air, which is great, but then it's not going to spend as much time underground. So, and I really can't get too much into that because I haven't played around with that too much. There might be information out there, but I decided to get the variable speed controller, and that was an extra $30 that they designed for this fan. But all that fan is, like, it's an inline fan that helps boost, you know, like the air. If you have one of those old houses with like a forced air heater, sometimes those forced air furnaces don't force the air enough, so they just like install this practically constantly running fans, you know, like in like a fan inside the duct, let's say to the further room of your house where you're not getting enough air movement, you just throw one of those like in the duct work and it helps move that air. And that's all it is. It's very low powered. And since we've used this thing, my wife and I have seen like pretty much no increase in our electric bills, like nothing, because it's just really, you know, like I'll get to in a second, you know, it's powered, intelligently by two thermostats. So it's not constantly running, you know, nor should it be. You only want it running when it's leaning towards one extreme or another. So yeah, that's all the information I got on the fan air movement. That's a pretty good proportion layout for you. And that, like, depending on the size of your greenhouse, if it's kind of similar in size, you might just be able to get away with one of these little inline duct booster fans. But otherwise, you can check out like Greenhouse Supply and Hydroponics Supply or one of those cannabis places, whatever, you know, like they've got some really nice fans out there.
How do you figure out how you calculate the speed of the fan? Like if it's going at however many cubic feet, like is there like a like, you know what I mean? Like, does the temperature thing that's coming in, like the, you know what I, do you understand the question I'm asking?
Yeah.
Like, is there a further calculation or consideration about, like, the speed that you keep the fan running at?
Yeah. So as mentioned, like, you know, I haven't really played too much with the variation in the speed. In fact, to tell you the truth, I haven't even been using that controller. However, there is kind of an answer to that question. So the CFM, the cubic feet per minute, you know, that does have everything to do with the speed. So, you know, like say you get a fan that is, you know, 135 cubic feet per minute. You know, but you're like, oh shoot, well, you know, like I really need 110, but they don't sell 110. They only have 130 and 100 feet. You know, this is just as an example, you know, I don't know if this is actually the case. So if you calculated that you needed about 110 CFM, and not 130, well, you certainly don't want to get the 100 CFM fan probably, because it's going to be a little bit underpowered. So what you can do is get the overpowered one. You get the 130 feet or CFM fan, and then perhaps get a variable speed controller to slow it down just a tad. And then assume that, hey, okay, that's probably landing at around 110, if that makes sense. So
that makes perfect sense. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And again, it's like, again, one of these, like, you know, best plan die on the battlefield scenario. Like, if you're running it and you realize, oh, this isn't, you know, the climate battery is not doing enough. You know, I'm going to turn the, you know, I'm going to turn it up. I'm going to make it so that it's pumping more cubic feet per minute or whatever. So,
That's exactly it. Cause a lot of this is just formulas and theory, which gets you started. But, you know, if I had a little more time on my hands, I'd probably really study it. You know, you and I know that permaculture principle like very well by this point, that, you know, it's just the observation, you know, and you can really study it and be like, oh, you know what? It seems to be more effective when I move a little less air and it spends more time underground, you know? So yeah, that, you know, that's the benefit of perhaps having the ability to, you know, like to vary your, like, you know, to control your speed of the fan. So that can, you know, that can be really valuable there. And also, yeah. So, just to move on that, like, so I, you know, I guess on the duct work, like I said, I used 8-inch galvanized duct work. It worked great for me. I spend less than $50 on, like, you know, on the duct work that I needed, for the plenums, like, you know, the air traps that, you know, basically like all those tubes I told you about, I needed like two ends, obviously, like two big cylindrical ends that I can essentially cut holes in and insert the ends of the tubing into, so that it all, you know, like it all gathers in, like, you know, in one area together and either, you know, goes out or comes in. You know, like I needed to connect all those tubing lengths. So I used a hole saw, like a 4-inch hole saw. And I, you know, like I wanted to cut those holes. So here's the funny and kind of, you know, like comical and sort of shameful part of what I did. If I could do one thing over again, this would be the first thing. Is it's going to sound silly, but for the plenum, you know, I was doing it on the cheap. I used those like, you know, buckets, like those white buckets that you get instead of 3, 4, 5 gallon. I'm sorry. I usually get 5 gallon buckets. I had like these old, like, you know, 2.5 gallon buckets that I cut the bottoms out of. And I like duct tape them together, in order to like make tubes. And then I used, you know, the tops of the two ends, like the tops of the lids of the bucket. And like, I sealed the lids. And so I had myself two chambers, you know, two plenums, like built out of taped up buckets. But the problem with that is, like, I figured, okay, I'll dig these in, I'll insert them into the ground, and, you know, the soil will just kind of work around it and shape and mold it to the shape of this thing. But, you know, soil does bear a lot of weight. And when you water things, there's even more movements and distribution of that weight. So in time, that duct tape is kind of given out a little bit. And so like those weaker edges and junctions have been kind of caving in a little bit, which has not been a problem so far. It's actually still holding its shape, but, you know, it's definitely a jury rig. What I recommend is actually those same 55-gallon drums I was talking about before to store your water in, you know, those would be great, like as a good example of two chambers or plenums to connect your tubing in. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And plus, people are always just giving those things away on Craigslist. I mean, those are, you know, those are pretty easy to find. But yeah, I don't know. I don't see why what you did wouldn't work either. It's the same concept, so.
Yeah, exactly. It worked in my mind, but yeah, it just didn't have that structural integrity of just one continuous container like those 55-gallon drums, you know, would have. But hey, you know, we keep learning from these things. So, but like I said, so far so good. It hasn't caved so much that any of these tubes have disconnected and just gone back into the soil. So that's really good. I'm gonna keep my eyes on those, but it's been 3-4 years now, so it's looking pretty good. As far as the thermostats,
you got your $20 worth out of those buckets.
Yeah, exactly. They were quite free. So yeah, it worked out. So yeah, as far as like, you know, the actual temperature control, because that's a really important aspect to this. Like I said, you want to just some way, however you need to rig it. You want it to kick on when it is too hot and adversely to kick on when it is too cold. So, I looked for kind of, you know, more commercial grade thermostats, and I really don't know what I'm doing with that kind of stuff. Like I had, but I was blessed to have a friend that's really into electrical. You know, he's like a contractor type guy. And so he like jury rigged it up for me, and he said, this will work as long as you don't like, you know, set the warm one below the temperature of what you set the cold one to. In other words, like if you basically make them both kick on at the same time, you could have kind of a, you know, like they, you know, it could blow your unit, like it could blow the thermostats. But yeah, so the way I did it was I had the electrician rig two thermostats, just one for the heat threshold and one for the cold threshold. And the ones that I used were from a maker called Johnson Controls, and the unit was called a Johnson Controls line volt mechanical thermostat for heating and cooling. And you can get those at like Grainger.com, probably Amazon, because they have everything, Global Industrial, like stores like that. Mine technically, if it matters, it was also rated for 120 to 277 VAC. I don't even know what that means. And they're cheaper now, but they're cheaper. They were cheaper then, but now they do cost $210 for two. So they're not super cheap. So if you could find an easier way to rig two thermostats, maybe cheaper variations of it, you know, I encourage you to do so.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's like the one piece that's really the most difficult part. So it's like you have those things and then, you know, they kick on when the temperature falls below, you have it set up. So when it falls below 42 degrees or something, it kicks on, and when it's over 70 or is that something you can change?
Yeah. Yes. So mine has like they have a dial on each. And again, they are kind of commercial because it does, you know, it gets a little wet in here. So you do want to take like details like that, you know, into consideration. But yeah, so mine are like pretty hefty and they're like, you know, they're manual. So like there are just these two like wheels, like dials, and they have the temperature rating there. And you know, there are different factors, you know, like trying to have the sun shine on it because that'll like, you know, mess with it and different things like that, which I think the sun is kind of like partially shining on mine. So, you know, like I have to take all those into consideration and I just get a feel for my temperature thresholds that I set. And obviously, in the winter, it'll be different than the summer. Like in the winter, I won't want it to go, you know, much warmer than, let's say, 60 degrees. So, you know, like I'll set at 60. And then it'll set, and then it'll kind of, you know, shut off once it gets something close to that. So, you know, but then in the summer, obviously it's going to get, you know, above 60 all the time. So I'll set that threshold at, let's say, like 90, you know, or 85 or something like that. So yeah, you just kind of play with it. And, you know, it's kind of a game of figuring out what's most effective in your area and what's needed. You know, if I can allow my greenhouse to go up to 90, 95 degrees, then I'll set it there because I don't want it to blow unnecessarily. So, yeah, you can kind of have fun with it and just, you know, see what's most effective in your situation.
That's awesome. So I guess my last question is about that technical piece in particular, though. It's like, so if somebody is going to get like their homie who's an electrician to come in and help rig the temperature thing up to the vent thing, like what kind of vocabulary, what sort of, like, how do you explain that to someone? Because I feel like this is the, like, as I have this whole idea of this thing in my head right now, that's the one piece that I'm still a little bit confused about. Like, how would I have an adult in the room. Like, what do I say to them? How do I do it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all I could say is like, yeah. If I have my homie that's like willing to jerry rig this thing, I'll just say, hey, I need two thermostats. Well, no, I wouldn't even say that. I need two functions, and I need two controls and two thresholds. All I need this thing to do is to be hooked up to, you know, be wired to this fan. All I need to do is for this one fan to be kicked on every time that it reaches or breaches, reaches and breaches my desired temperature on the warm side and the too cold side, like too warm and too cold. All I need to do is just fire on this fan every single time it hits A and B and just explain that there is a heat side and a cold side. And, you know, they'll probably help you figure it out. And they might. You know, they might know of a product like one unit, you know, that'll do that. Like for me, I was actually shocked that nothing really existed like that, because I think that a typical thermostat is wired for a home system that's going to kick on cooling and heating like two different units and not like a single unit, because this is kind of a unique application. So yeah, I would say, that's how I would describe it. And just to wrap up the details on my end, for anyone listening who wants to know more about, the equipment used or, you know, the materials used for the roofing top layer. I personally used, basically the brand is called Sequentia, Sequentia. Super 600 residential fiberglass panels. Those are like, you know, heavy duty, nice and thick. They're not the cheap Home Depot things. And it did cost me $325 for the roofing, but I did not want to cheap out on the roofing. And I'm really glad that I did not. You know, we've had hailstorms ever since then. And again, that sun is going to really eat away at the roofing very quickly. For the underground tubing, I used 4-inch corrugated and perforated ADS pipe, ADS like Adam, Daniel and Sam pipe, and like a drain sleeve. Some would recommend there's like this fabric-y sleeve that goes over it, but it's really optional. I didn't use it and I'm not having any problems with like dirt falling through the holes as far as I can see. So, that's for the tubing. Just trying to think if there's anything else here. That's about it. Except the numbers, just to let you know, the whole greenhouse was built for somewhere between, I estimate around $1,500 to $2,000. I think it's closer to around $2,000, which, you know, with solid wood and glass, that's pretty amazing. And I didn't even look for like used lumber or anything like that. I probably could have. But I spent like $875 on like quality lumber because I wanted to make the roof out of like 2x6s, and just really heavy duty lumber. I wanted this thing to last, but you could probably get away with cheaper than that. The actual subterranean heating and cooling system or battery, that cost me around $700. You can probably salvage more materials than I use, but just in case that gives you a good idea of what to expect for the cost of this thing. Those are the costs: $700 for the actual system and around $2,000 for my greenhouse.
That's so cool, man. I'm out here in Maine and in Colorado, it's like you you dig the pipes 3 feet under, but down here you'd want to do it 5 feet under because the winters are so brutal. Brutal. The winters are just brutal out here. You said you could send me your Google Doc information and maybe I could put some more technical drawings of like the way the I forget the technical word.
The plenums, like the, I'm sorry, the chambers, like the plenums.
Yeah. The plenums. Yeah. That was the word. So just maybe more technical, drawing on like what those look like. Cause I have it in my head, but that's cause I've seen it so many times. So are there any other considerations or challenges about building these things that you want to warn people about or tell people to think about as they're getting ready to do this?
I feel like I said most of everything just don't forget to have fun doing it. Expect to make a couple mistakes and that's okay. Think about like the most important aspects of it and capitalize on those. Ventilation again is key. The ground, having lots of bare ground is key. And you obviously need that to begin to implement a system like this anyway. Lots of plants in there is key, and really focus on structural integrity. We don't want anyone building greenhouses going to collapse under 3 feet of snow in Maine. Just think about like all those foundational things, that are going to be most important. And, mistakes from then on just become, a little less detrimental, if that makes sense. So yeah. Just think about what's most important and just enjoy yourself doing it.
I think it's really important that you said the thing about enjoying yourself, because when you're really getting into this stuff, it's so easy to be overwhelmed and to have like, this year I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And then you start implementing this stuff and like, oh wow, that thing I thought was going to take 4 hours took 2 weeks. And then it's like, I talk to some people and they get really stressed out and oh, I got to do this, I got to do this. And it's like, actually, you don't have to do that. Like, the world's not ending tomorrow. Like, everything's fine. Like, just enjoy yourself. Like, if you're not enjoying yourself while you're doing this stuff, then what's the point? It's just another miserable job. It's just another miserable aspect of your life that you're stressing out about. And, the whole point of this being like a holistic and healthy, part of our lives, like it's key to enjoy what you're doing, So I'm glad you said that.
100%. Yeah. No, that's very true. Yeah. And I had something to say, I totally lost that thought, but, yep. Everything you just said.
Well, cool, man. Oh. Well, what?
Yeah, I apologize. Yeah. So, in that, definitely recognize the value in planning and observing, like you just so eloquently said, like, enjoy yourself, take your time, and plan accordingly. For me, like I planned for, technically probably like quite a few years, cause this was like a small dream of mine just to have that little subtropical escape it like at my house. But however, like I spent like well over a year, like on the details, preparing it, laying things out, this is kind of for me, it's like attached to my house. So it's kind of a big thing. I really had to think about all those details. And, if you're like me, you'd easily like accidentally just skip over some really, really like crucial steps along the way. So yeah, definitely take your time, plan it out, and really, really take your time to observe, which again is just that really brilliant, permaculture principle.
Yeah. And you know what, the last thing I'll just throw in there is, for people listening to this interview, if this is all new, check out the interview I did a couple of years back with Stephanie do you remember Stephanie's last name?
Stephanie. Oh, I don't. I know who you're talking about, though. It's great.
With Stephanie from, Colorado, Rocky Mountain, Colorado Rocky Mountain, crimpy, Colorado Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, and they're kind of the people who I would say have like done the most and pushed this stuff to the furthest, and you can look at their videos by like Jerome Austin Towski on YouTube of like what they've done up in Aspen, in that area. And it's really inspiring. And like, you know, another element that when people don't really think about greenhouses is they think about them specifically as a place to grow food. Whereas like you're saying, like, I wanted to feel like California. And Stephanie was like, oh, I moved here from Florida. You know, I just want a place to go in the winter where I can be around tropical plants and hang out in a hammock and read. And it's the same thing for us out here. It's like the winters are so long and cold here. It would be so nice to be able to sit on a hammock under like a banana tree. And so it's like, you know, as they say in permaculture, like stacking functions and getting more utility out of it than just food, because it's about more than just food, you know?
Absolutely.
Awesome, Evan. Well, you know, I really, really appreciate you taking the time of like getting, you know, laying out all this information and like going over the technical details of it and sharing your love of this stuff with our listeners. And, I look forward to, visiting you in Colorado and seeing where things are next time I'm out there. And, I don't know if you have any famous last words or anything, any last points you want to get in about this conversation, that are like standing out to you?
No, I just say like, I would just say I really appreciate the interview and, anytime, any subject, man, it's a blast and, we'll have to do it again.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? I always ask all my guests, before we wind up, if there's any books that you're geeking out on right now or a book that you want to recommend to listeners. It doesn't even necessarily have to be about this subject.
Yeah. I mean, I love the Bible, man, but, hey,
you're a preacher. You're a preacher, right? You preach.
I always said I would never be, but that kind of that came about. So it's just, it's a lot of fun. As far as, these things, and I guess it does kind of, fit into exactly what we're talking about, but I really do recommend check out Back to Eden, the film. Yeah, it's got like several million views worldwide now, and it's just a game changer. It really changed my gardening life, and it'll sometimes even change your life in general, just seeing this amazing peaceful guy and just like what he learned, how he learned it, and how he implemented it. It was a beautiful thing.
That's awesome. Well, you know, my last thing is like, me as an atheist anarchist, you as a, Christian preacher, I love how, these material, or what you might even say spiritual, but like this love of, food and, autonomy and, it all, this is where, we can come together and find common ground and build, build a better world together, man. So it's awesome.
Yeah, no, I love exactly that, man. I feel like you are someone that you and I are two people that can probably come together, in those terms and on those different spectrums, and actually, have a full blown conversation, honest conversation, about like the, the two absolute, like, warned about, topics, which is politics and religion. And I would, and even then I would still be like absolutely confident that we would, it would actually be a two-way, respectful, awesome conversation. So, I've always enjoyed that about you. I enjoy our conversations and, I always welcome them further. If you ever want to get into, the interesting, topics of that, and, just questions that you'd be like, why the heck do you Christians think this or that or whatever? And, there are certain things that I can either dispel, get rid of, or just kind of, reinstate and just possibly bring clarity on. So yeah, man, I love it all. And I love the idea of just getting together and being able to do things like that and just affect the world around us.
Yeah, it's awesome. But it's more like, you know, in addition to all what you just said, it's like just how, you know, at the end of the day, you know, all these like abstractions in our lives, all these like things that are like peripheral, like when it comes down to it, you know, or when the shit hits the fan, it's like we're going to find that, you know, people who we might not think we have a lot in common with, you know, because of like our subcultural where we end up, you know, in our day to day or how we like self segregate in the society, you know, maybe we'll be surprised to find out that there are, you know, we can get along with and have a good time and break bread with a lot more people than this alienated society teaches us that we can, you know? So oh, I think that's awesome too.
Absolutely, man. All about it. There's absolutely no reason why not.
Well, so if people want to, you know, people want to follow you, or I don't know if you have like a Twitter or Facebook, or if you do any of that stuff, you could shout out your YouTube one last time, and then we'll, you know, I'll get back to childcare.
Yeah. I mean, you know, feel free to look for me on Facebook. That's a great way to communicate, or, you know, I mean, people share phone numbers on here. I don't care. I mean, you know, if you ever want to talk about any of this stuff, just, you know, like figure out how to get in touch with me, get in touch with Tim. You know, like, Tim, you have total permission to give my contact info to anyone that asks. I really don't care. I love people. I love engaging. I love talking. I love being able to discuss things like this and just really anything. On Facebook, it's Evan Dukas. I think I'm listed as in Denver or Wheat Ridge. I forget. You can find me on there. I'm always kind of, well, not always, but sometimes I'm kind of sharing things, you know, between the two topics that we discussed today, really. And then that YouTube channel is the Colorado Garden, and that should, you know, pop up with, I don't know, it's probably about 12 and 20 videos or something like that, you know, that I put up there that you might find helpful. So
that's awesome, and I just sent you a friend request over there, Evan. Yeah, well, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Days of rain, I know, far so away. Cruise, you know, control of an empty thing. Stop bidding, replaying, keep on changing.
You know, for
oh, there's rot and roll away, chasing fast into the grave. Fuck the good old dangers, keep on changing.
I'm sharing cool plants with you as I discover
my Christian friends pray for me.
Definitely, likewise, man. I'm sure I'm going to get a phone call from you when your face is in the dirt and you're trying to figure out, like, how to frame up a greenhouse wall. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it all.
I'm not shaking my fist, I'm clenching my teeth, I'm having a heart attack at the age of 33.
Hey, have a great day, brother.
Eat the world before it eats me. Spit it out before I am what I eat. Goddamn, this life ain't sweet. If it's what you seek, you should fight my waves. I'm on to bigger things like a back and play. Raps will say what means the most, except ain't no love songs, cause that is sacred to me. The side of me you see is a fighter, a writer. I came here to exile preachers and join the choir, clutching their pearls. They ask, what is this? Not here to cut deals, but erase all business.
Things arrange before you wake. Cruise control.
With no boss texting that we came for peace, but of course we brought weapons. This that shit that realizes freedom, born to a fiefdom, running through the eye of a needle. And I don't wanna go quietly, not loud, like every man's been trained to be. Talking louder than a bomb while you carry emperor's robe, no life in your palm. Your fate is controlled. I'll leave that talk for another time. This one's for the radio. Active waves, the bigger range of lies. How should we act like animals, machines, wanna be gods in a godless trap? The white man is still the fucking devil. I'm trying to soothe the hell inside of me. This shit outside I can't control. I'll be damned if I let the madness go unopposed.
Days arranged before you wake. Cruise control on empty tank. Stop bidding, we're playing. Keep on changing. Oh, that's right.
things arranged before you wake. Cruise control on an empty tank.
Stop it and replay it.
Keep on changing. Oh, there's rock and roll away. Chasing fast into the grave. No, fuck the good old days. Keep on changing.